It's my privilege to introduce our speaker, the Honorable John Hager. You see a picture of him there, and you see a book that he's written, which is exceedingly interesting, The Best Seat in the House. John Hager has a bachelor's in mechanical engineering from Purdue. Now, Purdue did us wrong the other day, but in any event, we'll forget that. And an MBA from Harvard. His sons both have MBAs from the Darden School here. He was Lieutenant Governor of Virginia from 1997 to 2001 and Republican gubernatorial candidate in 2001 and lost during the controversial Republican convention. The winner of the 2001 general election was John Warner, who asked John to set up and run the Virginia's Office of Commonwealth Preparedness, which was our state's Homeland Security Office. He was the Assistant Secretary of the Department of Education's Office of Special Education and Rehabilitation Services under George W. Bush. He became the chair of the Virginia Republican Party, but lost it in another controversial convention. The winner of that convention was fired a year later. He has continued to serve on too many boards to mention here, but I will highlight one. It's the Sorensen Institute right here at the University of Virginia. As you can see by his speech here at the Senior Statesman of Virginia, he hasn't really retired from service, for which we are grateful. Henry Lane Hull, a columnist for the Rappahannock Record, describes Mr. Hager as, quote, as the most, quote, beloved living Virginian, because of his unique combination of gentlemanliness with utter dedication to being of service to others, end of quote. Mr. Hager, John, would you please speak to us?
I think they probably know who I am by now.
Well, and there's this right here.
They'll have a chance afterwards. They can decide. Hi. It's good to see everybody. Thank you for being here today. We love Charlottesville. And I see some friends and lots of good people. So I appreciate the invitation. Richard DeMong was the original person who invited me. And then he's ill today, I understand.
Yeah.
So, but I've done lots of things here in Charlottesville. As he mentioned, our two sons graduated from the Darden School. I've worked with Larry Sabato at the Center for Politics. I've been a director of the Sorensen Institute with Lee Middleditch for many years and chairman for about 10. I've worked with the Batten School through the Outstanding Virginia program, and certainly done many programs over at the Miller Center with Bill Antholis. So I feel like I'm in sort of a part of Charlottesville, even though I live in Richmond. You know, people have asked me many times, why in the world would you write a book? Why would anybody write a book? Well, it's a good question. And I think the answer is, you know, it is first perhaps to record history. That's pretty obvious. You know, life goes fast. So much is soon forgotten. It's good to record and study and reflect. But I really didn't start out to write a book. One of our sons kept bugging me and said, I ought to capture some of my memories because, you know, I'd been fortunate to be involved in a lot of different things and accomplished a lot. And so how could I do that? And I was fortunate to meet a lady named Nancy Wheeler, who used to teach English at Collegiate School in Richmond. And she said she would work with me and do it the way I wanted to do it, which made me feel pretty good. And so we worked together for about a year, and it was really exciting. And I had a rough draft, and I happened to run into Larry Sabato, and I said, I've been working on a book. And he said, well, I'd love to see it. And so I gave it to him, And about 2 weeks later, he wrote me the nicest letter. He said, I read your draft. I loved it. I got a couple of changes. And he said, you got to go forward with it. And he was just very supportive. So that's when we got serious, and I started sharing it with a couple of other people, including my family, and they wanted to take lots of things out, obviously. But anyway, I got the corrections, and finally we got the pictures resolved, and we ended up with our book, which is over on the table over there. So the first reason is to record history. The second reason is to tell stories. People love stories. First accounts, reflections of others, interesting stories that reflect life, the idea that individuals make plans and achieve them in an orderly, progressive, and linear fashion is the way we think, but it's not the way it ever happens. It never happens. Change is a certainty. Nothing is so predictable as the unpredictable. And the world story is told in comedy and tragedy, laughter and tears. And not all endings are happy, but some are. And some are wonderful indeed. And my life is no exception. And these stories bring history to life. And the third, and perhaps the most important reason to write a book, is to inspire people. And that's one that never occurred to me. The mysteries of good and evil and achievement and despair and faith and doubt, well, I've got all the above, and my life has sort of followed that rolling hill of undulation that Churchill talks about in England. But I ran into Bob Holdsworth, who's another distinguished political analyst in Richmond. And he came back and he said, my life contains a message that transcends politics and should inspire us all. So I never really realized it. I never thought about it. But the idea that books have an impact on people and that they come away with some inspiration and some thoughts and some aspirations of their own is another exciting reason to write a book. So if you put that together, history, stories, inspiration, you've got the formula to work on a book. And the best name of my book is The Best Seat in the House. And so I had polio back in 1973. That's a long time ago. But since then, I've enjoyed life as a participatory sport in the game, not on the sideline. And life has been whole and exciting by doing rather than just observing. And so the up close and personal involvement with so many people, organizations and groups that have inspired me along the way, it's been very enriching and fulfilling. And people have been wonderful to help. And so I've always felt capable of success in a wheelchair. Now, wheelchairs are screwy things. You don't want to try one if you don't have to. The thing about a wheelchair is that it gets you where you're going, but, of course, you can turn over front ways and back ways and sideways and do flips and land on your head like I did one time and break your collarbone, or you can run into concrete posts and break your toes like I did one time when I was in a racing wheelchair. But anyway, they're a way to get us around. And what some people have seen as a handicap and said has sort of been enabling, not disabling. And it's been an opportunity to join others. And I've been involved with a lot of civic and charity and community and church and political and business organizations, and so sometimes I've been in the back, and sometimes I've been in the middle, and sometimes I've been in the front. Well, we call that every time the best seat in the house, and that's where the title of the book came from. So many people have been very critical to my achievement. I've got lots of people along the way have commented on the book and worked on the book, and it's just been such a help to me to be able to capture, you know, things and what has been happening in my life span over many years. Back in the very beginning, in the depths of World War II, I was hard at work on a neighborhood newspaper, clunked out on a real typewriter, and peddled to the houses surrounding us in the neighborhood. But this action of work and entrepreneurship became sort of a habit with me, and habit becomes character, and character ultimately becomes destiny. So after Purdue and Harvard, and I worked on our group thesis, which we actually sold after business school. So it was a grand ride. And then I was in the U.S. Army from ROTC and went to work for the American Tobacco Company with family heritage and a challenging opportunity to work up from the bottom over a period of a few years. And I moved 13 times until 1970, went on a trip to Richmond. I met Maggie here, even though we both lived in New York City. And it was love at first sight. And she's the real hero of the venture. And Maggie's right back there in the blue shirt. You wave your hand. So we were married in Richmond, and my work progressed. And son Jack was born, and I was promoted to executive vice president of Fortune 500 company at a young age. So we sold our house, and we were moving to New York City. And then at that point, all of a sudden, our life basically closed. I was felled by the unknown, driven down by misdiagnosis, unnecessary operations, staph infection, floundered in the local hospital for about 2 months. So it was a real downer. And not a very happy time. It was a friend of Maggie's who recommended the Rusk Institute in New York, and somehow I made it up there. And Dr. Rusk took a personal interest in my case. The polio diagnosis came through. Dr. Jonas Salk got involved due to the fact that I had actually gotten polio from his arch enemy, Albert Sabin's vaccine. And so this was a very interesting situation. And Dr. Russ said, "Well, it's good news, you got polio." I said, "Well, tell me about this good news." And he said, "Well, it's not debilitating and you can recover, and maybe you'll be all right." So that was another 2 months of slow rehabilitation and the road back. And the company decided I'd be better off in Richmond rather than New York. But at least we had made it. And before long, I was strong enough to dive back in, back to work, joining any group that would have me, trying crutches to get my feet on the ground, only to learn that racing wheelchairs were a much more satisfying form of exercise. So I just sort of got going. A few mishaps in the wheelchair didn't slow me down. Traveling all over again, working my way back up. And we had a great house, great friends and neighbors. Son Henry was born. Maggie, the good mother, made it all happen. And so I got involved in lots of different organizations, and I was very excited to be involved. Good political friends urged me to run for the General Assembly, but I needed a job, and I didn't want to give up my job. The whole idea seemed very remote, that politics was something I had never thought about, never had time for, never really was that interested in. But I did agree to volunteer and sort of start at the bottom like I had in business. And so that led to being elected a delegate to the 1980 Detroit Republican National Convention. That was when Ronald Reagan was nominated in Detroit And it was quite a time. I had met Maureen Reagan in Richmond at the state convention, and so I got invited to several events in Detroit, and I come to find out everybody thought I was John East, who was a senator from North Carolina who was also in a wheelchair. And so between knowing Maureen and security wasn't that tight in those days, I suddenly was going to all these fancy political events. And John and Eddie Dalton were there, and they had the state limo. And they asked me to ride with them. And so that was a big help, because our motel was way out of town. And my roommate was the infamous Bob Patterson from Richmond. Well, Bob would say, wait for me to arrive at the convention before you go in. And I said, well, why is that? He said, well, I'll tell you. So I would get down there and talk to people and wait outside for Bob. Well, he came along with his fifth of Scotch whiskey and would tape it under the wheelchair and push me in. And I said, well, I don't allow anybody to push me. He said, well, that's all right. Let me just push you through security. Of course, security wasn't so much in those days. So anyway, he made lots of friends that way. And he would have his fizz of scotch in the convention floor every night. And so it was quite an experience, this my first political convention. And on top of everything else, we had Elizabeth Taylor, was there with John Warner. With John Warner, they were beginning to have a little friction, and John would stay downtown after the convention at night. And by then, Elizabeth had had several glasses of wine, and I was the one that was recruited to get her to her room because I was young, and they'd say, well, you hold on to the back of the wheelchair. And I would roll gently to the room and open the door and give her a little shove in and do my job. So between all these experiences, I decided that politics wasn't so bad after all. So I finally got back to Richmond and began to work my way up in the political process, joining committees, working for campaigns. And for about the next 15 years, I was the consummate volunteer. Over the years, I've been to 8 national conventions, and too many stories to cover here, that's for sure. Back in 92, of course, this was 80 when I went to Detroit. So in 92, I ran for chairman of the party, barely losing, but becoming co-chairman of the victory campaign of George Allen and Ollie North and others, covering the state and enjoying getting to know people and learning about the game of politics. Well, I was still working, and I had worked my way sort of back up the ladder, and I had that same conflict between having a full-time job and doing well and having this avocation in politics. Well, suddenly it was announced that the American Tobacco Company was going to be sold. A real shock to me, a real shock to the people that worked for me, because we were doing very well. The members of the operating committee, which I was, were offered full retirement. And so I didn't really know what to do. I was too young to retire, and I wasn't proficient enough in politics, but it was sort of a crossroads. And the die was cast. Maybe I would give it a shot. Well, how could I run in politics? There were no jobs. My delegate was Hatcher Crenshaw, a friend. My senator was Joe Benedetti, a friend. My congressman was Tom Valley, a friend. I'm not a lawyer. I can't be attorney general. I wasn't going to run for governor right away. That was too pretentious. So the only thing left was lieutenant governor. It was 2 years out from the 1997 election, and I said, well, maybe I'll give it a shot for lieutenant governor. But there was this fellow named Coleman Andrews, who was already running on the Republican Party for lieutenant governor. And he was from Northern Virginia. And in case you hadn't noticed, there are more people living up there than there are down here, which means there are more votes up there. He was a very attractive guy, sort of a glamour boy. He was young and good looking and had lots of money. And everybody said, well, Coleman Andrews is going to get that nomination. You don't have a chance. And I said, well, we'll give it a try and we'll see what works out. And I had a big kickoff party, and I had tremendous support in the Richmond area and in the South Side and down at Virginia Beach. And so we had quite a contest going, but it was still an uphill battle, and I figured maybe I didn't really have a chance. But we did some research on my friend Coleman Andrews, and it turned out he had a few cracks in his story. And in fact, it turned out they were fairly big cracks. And as we got close to the primary election, about a month out, he decided to resign from the contest. Some things that were going to come out that were not very savory about him did him in. So he resigned from the contest, and I got the nomination. So this nomination that was going to be impossible for me to get, I was suddenly the Republican nominee for lieutenant governor. Well, all that did was put me in another contest with L.F. Payne. You probably know L.F., who lives here in near Charlottesville. Very fine man, conservative, relatively conservative Democrat. Had served in Congress for 10 years. Was on the Ways and Means Committee. And he was a formidable candidate for lieutenant governor. So they said, "Well, you can't possibly win that contest. You know, LF is strong." And so we dove in again. And this time we came up with a concept that I would roll across Virginia. In Virginia, there are 134 cities and counties. There are 100 counties and 34 cities. And so I said, well, I would go to each and every one of the 134 cities and counties and do an event. And I patterned it a little bit after Doug Wilder's campaign, where he went and started in Southwest Virginia and spent 3 months coming across Virginia. Well, we had a TV commercial that showed me in the wheelchair. In this case, it was a racing wheelchair, leaving from the house, getting ready to roll across Virginia. And so once I met people in all 134 cities and counties, it turned out that my campaign got pretty good traction. And then we had some debates, and I was fortunate to do well in those debates with LF. And Jim Gilmore was running for governor, and he had the no car tax appeal. And so altogether, we finally got to election day, and I was still the underdog. And I went to Northern Virginia to work in the 8th and the 10th and the 11th district that day, just because symbolically I knew that that's where the votes were. And in the car coming back to Richmond, here again it was Larry Sabato who called, and he said, guess what? I said, what? He said, you're going to win. And I said, you got to be kidding. He said, no, I can't believe it either. He said, but you're going to win. So I did. I won. In fact, we won by a pretty good margin. And so what it turned out to be a business career was now transformed into, after it had been a civic career, then it was a political career. And so it was sort of a shock. I went down to the Senate to see the clerk of the Senate, Susan Clark Schar, and she had brought in an engineer and designed this fancy elevator that was going to take me up to the podium. And I said, well, you know, I don't think we need to go to all that trouble. I said, those things are unreliable and noisy and pretentious, and I think we got to do something different. And she said, well, what could we possibly do? And I said, well, if you go over here in the corner, I said, we can get some lumber. I know a fellow that owns a lumber company who can donate to lumber, Johnny Sewers, and we'll just put a few boards down, and I'll just roll up to the podium. And she looked at me like I was crazy, but it did work. We built a ramp out of some boards, and she put a rug on top of it. But I was able to come in and go over to the wall and roll up to the podium, so we didn't have to have any elevators or anything like that. And it was a marvelous occasion to be sworn in as Virginia's lieutenant governor in 1998. The first person in a wheelchair in America to serve in a statewide office, so that was quite an experience, and I enjoyed every minute of the 4 years I was a full-time lieutenant governor. So after the session, the lieutenant governor, of course, presides over the Senate, and you're involved with the legislation and everything, and you do some work with the governor, but essentially, the offices are independent of each other. And I went around the state and served on a lot of committees and commissions, and had a great experience trying to make a difference, trying to do good and constructive things for Virginia. And it was a marvelous 4 years. And of course, some of the staff said, well, you got to run for governor. I said, no, I think I'll stay lieutenant governor. Oh, no, you can't do that. No one lets you rest in this world, so you got to run for governor. So that's when the contest with Mark Early came along. And in this case, it was not going to be a primary. It was going to be a convention. And you've probably heard about some of these nominating conventions where narrow special interest groups tend to control the convention, and they turn out their delegates at the local level. And so he was good at that. He was a very hard to the right on the abortion issue, and he had a lot of appeal to the special interest groups. So I was somewhat behind in getting delegates, even though I still think we had a good chance, because some places we were very strong. And but I decided I would meet with Mark, and I agreed that I would drop back to lieutenant governor, and he could take the nomination. Well, he had a staffer that convinced him over the weekend to go back and renege on his promise. And we had a press conference all set up, and he decided he didn't want to do that, agree with me, and endorse me for lieutenant governor. So we went on with the convention, and I barely lost. But it was sort of disruptive and sad, and particularly when he got clobbered in the general election. Many times the people we nominate in conventions don't win the election, which, after all, should be the goal. But I had made many good friends in the Senate, and I was enjoying my work immensely. And so I continued to carry on, and on a bright, sunny day, I was driving to Washington. It happened to be September the 11th of 2001, and I had an old car phone in a box, and I had an early version of a cell phone. They both rang at the same time, turn around, come back. So I turned around and went back to the Capitol. I beat Governor Gilmore to the Capitol. And that was truly a day of craziness, 9/11. I'm sure everyone remembers where they were and what they were doing. But during that day, we were asked what were the prime targets in Virginia. And we sat down on the third floor listing all these targets, not thinking that we would be a target. Of course, I'm sure we might have made other people's lists. And if you thought about it, it wasn't a very smart place to be. But it was such a bizarre day. We had several press conferences, several meetings, all kinds of concern when planes were still in the air. The Pentagon got hit, of course, and the Pentagon is in Virginia. It was a tragic day, and life had changed for just about everybody. But life changed for me because I suddenly that day became Homeland Security Director. I'm not sure I knew how to spell it, but it was very interesting to suddenly be so involved, and because I was available, and it just was logical that I would become Homeland Security Director. So I finally, about midnight, wanted to drive home, and Capitol Police said, "No, we have to go with you." And I said, "Lord, things really have changed." But the mindset was such that this couldn't happen. This wouldn't happen. This didn't happen. But yet it did. And it just was unbelievable. And I remember going to New York and smelling the stench of bodies up there in the World Trade Center site. I remember going to the National Cathedral and when they had the wonderful service to celebrate the memory of the people who had been hit on that day. And it was obviously a very interesting time. And I knew well Mark Warner, the Democrat who had defeated Mark Early, who had defeated me in the convention. And so Mark Warner said, "Will you serve as a cabinet member for me? And we'll make you Homeland Security Director, continuing from one administration to the other, so we would have continuity." And I decided, I felt like, I talked to lots of people and felt like I should do that because it just was so important to Virginia to have the contacts and to continue the work we had done in the short time between September and January. So I stayed on as Homeland Security Director for 3 years. And that was a three fascinating years because Virginia is so closely aligned with Washington, D.C., which is not only where most of the money comes from, but it is a target itself. And we had the National Capital Region committee, which was representatives of Maryland, D.C., Virginia, and the federal government. And we met almost continuously during that time. After 3 years, I decided that it was time to maybe try something different. So I agreed to go into the Bush administration, and I became the director of OSHRS, which is the Office of Special Ed and Rehabilitation Services, affecting, 6 million special ed students in the United States and about 2.5 million people at any one time under active rehabilitation under federal programs. So that was a very interesting time, an interesting ride, and a real challenge as well. So where was Henry all this time? It was, after all, Henry who had worked in my campaign for lieutenant governor. And after I had lost the campaign for governor, he went to Washington and had become an intern in the White House and later become Karl Rove's assistant. And he was transferred to the 2004 reelect campaign of George W. Bush as staff secretary and scheduled the first family for their political activity. And that's when he met Jenna, and the rest is history. They were married in that Texas ranch wedding about 10 and a half years ago, and both have done so much since. It was great to see Jenna this weekend. Was in Vietnam with Michelle Obama and Julia Child, Julia, what's her name, one of the movie actors. Anyway, they were doing a program for the empowerment of women and girls. And so she's been amazing, as Henry has, and now we have three grandchildren by them and three by Henry's brother Jack in Philadelphia. So six grandchildren is a wonderful thing as well. There's so many stories I can tell and so much I can cover, but maybe it's time to reflect on politics a little bit. I can tell you it's not the same old game. So much has changed just in 10 years. The internet, social media allows people to do anything, and there are no policemen. The biased media, mountains of money, gerrymandering, polarized politics, the decline of the parties. There's enough material there for a book. I think somebody comes out with one just about every week. And alas, Virginia's become nationalized. Back about a month ago, we voted in Virginia, in the Virginia election, and for the most part, the perception of Washington and the leadership in Washington and the court ordered district lines and vast sums of out-of-state money determine the results of the election. So people are turned off, and everybody is perplexed and polarized, and gridlock prevails, and we watch all these crazy news programs on television. So it's a different ballgame, as I say. I'm sort of retired from it, but I miss it. Bob Holdsworth says, when so many are cynical about politics, my book is a welcome antidote. So I hope perhaps if you're interested, you'll get a copy of the book. And I hope perhaps you'll have lots and lots of good questions to ask me. And that's sort of a thumbnail sketch. And I hope a good one, Bob. So let's get into some questions. Is that a good time? Thank you.
Talk about that. So you finished on a real down note, right? Politics has gone to hell in a handbasket.
Right.
Is there any hope?
Well, we've always had hope in this country, and I sure hope there's hope. You know, these things tend to cycle in history, and history is a great lesson. So I would think there would be hope. I mean, there have been tough times before, and we've come out of it. I guess the hard thing to deal with today is how fast change takes place. And what does change mean? Are we changing for the better, or are we changing for the worse? We know things are going to change, and the next generation is going to change again. But let's hope that it's all in a constructive way.
Gene Acton.
Yes.
You have to.
They got a mic somewhere. Here it is.
Gene Acton Davis, right here.
Lieutenant Governor Hager, you and Governor Gilmore ran on the repeal of the car tax.
That's right.
And the localities were upset because they wanted the revenue. And so it wasn't repealed completely, but it was partially repealed. And now, again, it's come before the legislature as an issue. So what do you think is going to happen to the car tax?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I'll give you a little background. The reason that it was particularly Governor Gilmore who concentrated so much on no car tax is because it was the most unpopular of all the taxes. All the taxes that we pay, people really don't like the car tax. It all came at one time. You were always surprised because it was more than it was the year before. And it was hated a tax, and that's why he concentrated on it. But in the end, it was up to the General Assembly to implement it. It wasn't up to the governor. So when the issue got to the General Assembly, they refused to enact the car tax the way he proposed it. They only enacted a piece of it. And when the state reimburses the locality for the amount of the car tax, they do it based on what it was at that time, not with the inflationary increase each year. So that's why the localities were never totally satisfied. They got reimbursed, but they only got reimbursed at the rate the year that it was replaced. And so the General Assembly has played with it every year since. It's always a bill every year because, and I think we're up to about 60%, if I recall, that 60% of the car tax has been repealed. And as I say, the General Assembly controls it. Now, the reason it'll come up this year is because some people will want to go back the other way. But it's just political jockeying. You know, money is money. It's all fungible. And taxes are a way to get money. So some people like more and more money to spend as government. Some people like less. And that's why they're always arguing over taxes.
But reference the national and the state level. As a long-term fiscal conservative, I'm very, very concerned at the debt we are passing on to our kids and grandkids.
Sure.
In the last 20 years, when we've had Democrats in the White House, the amount of the deficit has decreased. And when we have the alleged fiscal conservative Republicans in the White House, it is skyrocketed. We are now up to $23 trillion in debt, which we are passing on to our kids and our grandkids. And I want to know, why did the Republicans abandon what used to be the center of the policy platform of the Republican Party?
Good question. I don't really think he did abandon it. I think it was up here again to the Congress. I don't think the president could decree that spending be reduced. I think he tried. But it's the Congress that appropriates the money, and that's what determines the debt.
The latest big boost on the national level, at least, has been caused by the huge tax cut for the wealthy,
right?
Not by any boost in spending.
Well, and of course, part of the concept of that tax cut is that it would stimulate the economy, and I think that has happened, and I think.
In the last 31 months of the Obama administration, there was about double the. In the last 31 months of the Obama administration, there was about double the job creation of the first 31 months of the Trump administration.
Well,
we're on an upswing, and God, we hope it continues, but it hasn't boosted the economy.
In the upswing, the idea is the taxes would increase. With the stock market up, you get more capital gain tax. With more economic activity, you should get more income tax. And so that theoretically, a strong economy helps offset some of the spending. But the problem is spending. The problem is not the tax. In my opinion, the problem is Congress, and they spend too much. And we have to balance the budget at the state level in Virginia, as you know. So there's not a debt problem at the state level because the budget has to be balanced every year. I assume you have to balance your budget. It would be nice if the federal government had to balance their budget, and we wouldn't have to worry about whether it was a Democrat or a Republican. But if
we wasn't an amendment.
There was a balanced budget amendment going forward. Do you know what happened to that?
They're usually defeated. There's been one every year. there have been lots of them. They've been defeated, unfortunately.
All right. The next hand I saw was Jean Ecton Davis.
With the car tax before the legislature now, what do you predict will happen, and what are the issues that influence that?
Well, I think probably nothing will happen. That's what generally happens in the General Assembly. they'll talk about it a lot, but if they've got other taxes that provide a significant, you know, the amount of money that's needed in the budget, they'll leave the car tax as it is. Now, that's the amount of reimbursement. That doesn't mean the tax itself won't go up, because the locality controls that. So the amount you're reimbursed may not offset as much in the future as it does now. So it's a tricky, sort of a tricky thing. Yes, ma'am. Who's next?
In Virginia, like in much of the country, most of the economic growth seems to be concentrated in urban areas, and rural areas are dying. Young people are moving away because there are no jobs and no opportunities. In Virginia, this is made worse because, like education, so much of education is funded at the local level. So poor rural counties don't have the support for their education system. So is there something that we could do in Virginia to strengthen our rural areas?
Well, that's a great question. Very timely. Last Friday, I attended what's called the Virginia Economic Summit, which was at the Greater Richmond Convention Center, sponsored by the Virginia State Chamber of Commerce. And the governor was there, Senator Kaine was there, former Governor Allen was there. Lots of significant people in Virginia were there, along with 925 other people. And they talked a lot about the Go Virginia initiative, which is regional collaborations to attract economic development. They talked a lot about site preparations to have sites available for companies that want to come in. They talked a lot about the transformation of Roanoke into this Carilion and the medical complex that's had such an impact in Roanoke. They talked a lot about Southwest Virginia and efforts that are being made there to bring in new companies. So I would say that while your observation is correct, I would say that there are a lot of very good people working hard on trying to change the economic climate.
On a lighter note, where does the lieutenant governor reside?
At home.
Okay. So how does the lieutenant governor do all the things that the lieutenant governor is expected to do if his home is, say, in the western part of the state?
Well, it just depends on whether they have a second home in Richmond. Most lieutenant governors that have not lived in Richmond have had an apartment or a way to spend most of their time in Richmond, even though they might live somewhere else. Well, there are some expenses that are covered. It's a very low salary, as you know. I think it's like $35,000. You spend $1 million to get a $35,000 job. Most of the current lieutenant governor lives in Northern Virginia, but he's in Richmond a lot. But he doesn't have to be a full-time lieutenant governor. He doesn't want to be. Now, I was, but that's voluntary. In essence, it could be, if you did the least, you'd be like a member of the legislature and a member of certain committees and commissions.
You know, I'm concerned about all these shootings that are going on, the most recent one in Jersey City.
Sure, it was awful.
And I'm just wondering, what are your thoughts on gun control?
Well, my thoughts are that it's not the guns that are doing this, it's the bad people. That I think some reasonable gun control is a good thing, particularly background checks and anything that's logical like that, keeping guns out of the hands of people that have mental concerns. I mean, but basically it goes back to the foundation of our country. It goes back to the family. It goes back to the church. It goes back to how we live our lives. It's the bad people that are going to get guns, whether we control them or not, that are going to cause the trouble. And so we've got to work on our foundational aspects. Mm-hmm. Well, most of the legislation that's been proposed can be gotten around is the common sense way of saying it. I'm not necessarily opposed to all of it, but I don't think it'll make that much difference. It's what will make a difference is if you get good people, you know, with good intentions dominating in the country and not letting the gangs and all the terrible things that happen.
I'd like to ask you to relate some of the anecdotes that you have, mm-hmm. stories like at the 1980 convention or some of your favorite stories and when you were a lieutenant governor.
Well, I had lots of interesting stories when I was lieutenant governor. One night when I went home, we had a long break between the session that sort of adjourned like at 5 o'clock, and we were going back in session at 8 o'clock that night. We were close to the end of the General Assembly. So I drove home to have dinner and see my family and open the mail. And I was driving back downtown, and I got off the expressway. I was on 9th Street at the stoplight, and this car came careening over the Manchester Bridge and clobbered me in the back. And I went spinning around and ended up in the geranium patch over at the building, like across the street. And this was a teenager who had stolen a car and was being chased by the police. Had no driver's license. So I was stunned, and the police showed up right away. And even though I was stunned and I had hit my head on the top of the car, and the wheelchair had actually gotten bent in the back seat. And I said, I've got to get to the General Assembly. I'm supposed to preside. I'd never missed a minute of presiding, you know. And so I got out, and we bent the wheelchair back in shape and got in the police car and went on to go preside in the General Assembly. And by then it was on television that I had had this wreck. I mean, this guy had run into me. And so the clerk, the same Susan Shaw, she looked at me like I was a ghost, and she said, "Are you still here? And are you going up there to preside?" And I said, "Yeah." And I babbled, hit the gavel and went back in session about 8 o'clock. Well, it dragged on for 2.5 hours, and by then the top of my head was full of blood. And she would turn around and look at me. She was so mad at me. Anyway, finally we finished the session, and she had two policemen waiting to haul me off to the hospital. And fortunately, everything was okay. I had just banged my head. But that was an interesting story. We were much more convivial in those days. People, everybody would do things together, and they would attend these receptions. Now you go to a reception during the General Assembly, there are no General Assembly members there. It's just the lobbyists and the people that are sponsoring the receptions. It's sad in a way, the way it's changed, because people used to work together. One of my most interesting pieces of legislation I did with Emily Kirk, we did what was called the Commonwealth Neurotrauma Initiative, which is still very active. And she and I worked on it together and co-sponsored it. So, I mean, you can do things like that, or you could in those days. There's always a dramatic moment in the General Assembly because you're always up against deadlines. You see, we only meet for 45 days in the short session and 60 days in the long session every other year. And whereas, like Congress, they meet all year long. And many states meet all year long. We would meet in these short sessions, so there's always a deadline. And if you look at the calendar of the General Assembly, it's just pocketed with deadlines, the budget deadline and this deadline and that deadline. And on a certain day you elect judges, and on a certain day you have the page party, and every minute is occupied. And so when you don't have any extra time, you get into all these crunches. And that's when funny things happen. So I've got lots of good stories. And the lieutenant governor, of course, breaks the tie-breaking votes. And I had the one, I guess the most famous one that I broke was sending the lottery profits to education. And they still theoretically do go to education, although the budget, you play games with the budget, and it's fungible, you know. Other questions?
I have one more.
Sure.
You've written about how it's regrettable that conventions tend to select people that can't win in the general election.
But
that also happens in primaries, and I also think that
it
happens in both parties.
Mm-hmm.
If you could do it, whether it's practical or not, how would you like to see things organized so that you don't end up with people at both ends of the spectrum being the ones that are nominated?
It's an imperfect process. I mean, I don't know what you – that's a question that begs an answer. We've tried lots of things. And now his question basically is about the nominations. Some people think that we should do a different form of a convention. They have where you basically set up polling booths, about 10 in an area. They've got a name for it. What is it? Doggone it. I can't remember. But it's like a convention, but it takes the acrimony out of it. You go to a firehouse and vote, but you don't have the gathering. You don't have the real major gathering.
So you try to avoid having firebrands voting about things, right? Yeah.
There are other ways to do a nominating contest. In other words,
yeah. Thank you all for being here. Thanks again, John, for a wonderful talk.
Thank you.